I back him up against the door. After a while, he picks me up and in one easy movement reverses our positions, pushing me hard into the panelling. He has my dress up around my waist before he stops. I open my eyes, the skin around my mouth buzzes. He is looking down at my thigh holster. I wonder what excuse to make. A strange expression crosses his face, and then his mouth covers mine again. About the time I think the panelling may give way, the blue room camera winks and dies. Daniel has turned off the CCTV. He is missing out. You need to be pretty fit to pull off a standing orgasm. Check. Roman, the challenger says after a while. Winter. There is a discreet knock at the door. Harry's muffled voice comes through the battered panelling.
Winter, there's someone outside asking for you.
Good.
Simon.
Typical, not a representative of global organised crime. I look at Roman, his bow tie hanging loose, his shirt out. Just fucked hair really suits him. I wonder how soon he could go again.
Winter, did you hear me? Harry asks louder.
I turn the key in the lock and pull the door open. The hall is quiet after the main salon. I wait while Harry gets my fur, resting my foot on the grate. The fire crackles and spits a hint of green. Simon's lanky frame appears in the doorway. He looks out of place with his dishevelled hair and crumpled clothing. Your timing sucks, I say. Attack is the best form of defence. The velvet drapes part behind me, and Roman Constantine stands on the threshold. I'm staying at the Ritz, he says. I head down the stone steps and up into the service Range Rover. Simon puts his foot down before I've even got the door shut.
What the hell are you doing?
His knuckles are white on the steering wheel. Baiting a trap? Testing a theory? 2 hours out in the open and no show.
Getting laid? What? Who?
Some billionaire.
Simon looks like he might be sick.
What the hell are you doing? I demand. You are supposed to be finding a trail.
I've got something, he says. A prepaid, initialized on Rue de Vieux Grenadier 2025. Entered the Marché de Plainpalais 2045.
Disappeared an hour later.
And?
On its own, a prepaid tells us nothing.
And? I have a regular phone turned off 2024, right beside it on Rue de Vieux Grenadier.
I breathe out. I had been holding my breath. Chapter 14. The night streets of the city are deserted. We pass St. Paul's on our right, its dome uplit. Paternoster Square is on our left.
I came to tell you, he says, but you were gone.
I don't suppose it comes with a name and a contract. Simon shakes his head. It doesn't matter. We can track its signature back up the line. He could change it every week and we would still get something. I stare out of the window. Even with Max's algorithms, we are looking at a vast amount of new data to sift through. Billions of signals crisscross the globe. We need to track one unique signature mast to mast, finding the handoffs one by one, like high-tech gingerbread crumbs. Where will they lead? Where is home? I know it will be Moscow. Urban terrain. The Pico cell covering two or three streets. A night cleaner is stacking stools on tables in Pret on the corner. 2 hours out in the open.
Not long enough to be sure.
Get back, find Max and trace it. Get me an end location, I say.
Where are you going?
The Ritz. The Merc screeches to a halt in the middle of Cheapside.
Are you mad? You can't be out here. Every contractor in Western Europe is probably heading our way.
There's nothing on Firestorm. No one turned up at the colony. Get the program running and call me when you have something.
Simon is furious. I can just tell from the angle of his jaw as he squints in his mirror.
If you have to go, I'll wait outside, he says.
He wants to wait outside while I get laid. Classic.
Get back to the office and find me a location. It's time for you and Max to pull your fingers out. We have to go round the block to come at the road entrance to the Ritz, the right way up the one-way street. A doorman steps up to open my door.
I am not happy about this, Simon says.
Go! You're blocking the traffic.
Simon is looking in his side mirror as he pulls out. I slam the door on his reply. The neat little major domo answers the door to the penthouse suite. I give him a winning smile.
Hi.
Nothing. Not a flicker.
Is he back yet?
He looks me up and down.
Is this a social call?
As opposed to what, I wonder.
He blocks the door, one hand on the door jamb, a weird mix of proprietary and protective. I make his mind up for him by ducking under his arm and walking in. The sitting room of the Ritz penthouse suite is black and gold and cluttered. What is it about penthouse suites and gold? I circle a couple of small tables and make for the sound of running water. The bedroom is empty. The sound is coming from the ensuite. Our eyes meet in the huge mirror. Roman is standing with his back to the door, a white towel wrapped round his waist. He won't be needing that.
I stand naked, considering the room service menu. What shall I get you?
Roman is face down on the carpet. He lifts his head, but no sound comes out. I order steak for two and put the phone down.
I tell you what, I say. Why don't you sit this next one out?
I climb on the bed, spread my legs, and use one finger so as not to block the view. His head gets higher and higher, and his eyes wider and wider until he is crawling up the end of the bed, across the sheet, and on top of me.
Christ, he says, as he sinks deep.
I hook his leg, flip him over onto his back, and use his hands to move myself up and down.
Don't mind me, he says.
After I've come riding his perfect 22-year-old body, I climb off and finish him with my mouth. Room service knock just as he grips the sheets, pumping down the back of my throat. After that, he doesn't seem to be getting up, so I eat the steak and chips myself, check the door, and curl up beside his warm sleeping body, thinking about the 12 and their scrolling counters, and John J. Traynor, a man who spent his whole life helping others, beaten to death by a pair of iron fists. Early morning sun wakes me. 5 a.m. and not a contractor in sight. I feel as fresh as a daisy. Roman is lying fast asleep on his side, the sheet hanging off his perfect washboard stomach. I lift the sheet. He seems to have recovered. I push him back gently, straddle his hips and lower myself onto him. As I come down, his eyes open sleepily. Morning, I say.
When I was a boy, Roman says afterwards, we had this tradition down on the plains.
He rolls on his side to face me, the sheet hanging off him. A man would wait at the start line on his fastest horse, and a woman would gallop past him. If he caught her before the mile marker, she was his for the night.
And what if he didn't catch her?
If she reached the mile marker without being caught, she turned and the hunter became the hunted. The women carried long training whips. I was 14. There was this girl, black-eyed, wicked. She lorded it over the other women. I nod. I know the type. Anyway, I begged my brother to let me compete. I was already a good rider, fast and fearless. I watch him, curious.
And what happened?
I prompt when he doesn't continue. He rolls onto his back, his arms over his eyes. He gave me the slowest donkey in the place. He said to me, "If you want something badly enough, you will make it happen. Find a way."
And did you?
No. He won himself. I laugh.
And what happened? He slept with her.
No. Roman sits up. He just wanted to put me in my place. So that night I crept into her house and made it happen. Women had trouble saying no even then. I push him over in disgust. He falls onto his back laughing. Brothers, it makes me glad I'm an only child.
Why was it up to him?
Roman's face twists. He is 15 years older than me. I never knew my parents. I process this, brought up by a domineering older brother. He has no time for women. You should hear him. His voice turns stern. Women are weak, and they make you weak. They suck you in and drag you down, surround you with their soft, pillowy limbs, and suck the life out of you. He rolls his eyes. He never stopped lecturing when I was growing up.
So is he gay?
Roman laughs. No, no. Definitely not. He's never met a woman yet who said no to him. I find that tends to be the case for most billionaires. Roman shakes his head, half jealous, half admiring. It's always been the same. You should see women with him. They just fall at his feet.
I'm sure.
I remember this one time we were in a club and this woman just went down on him. That kind of club. Yeah, that kind of club. And afterwards he went to tip her.
As you do.
And she said, "That's okay, I don't work here."
And what did he say?
I don't think he knew what to say. He never lets women get close, you know. Emotionally.
A buzzing. I lean forward to get my phone from the tangle of white satin beside the bed.
Simon.
You had better not be checking up on me.
I have something, he says. His voice is hopeful. I smile. Quick work even for Max and Simon.
Let's have it.
A live number. I'm on my way. I swing my leg over Roman's body and stand up.
You can't go. Stay for breakfast.
He clings on, his cheek pressing into my bare back.
Stay for supper.
I break his hold and push him backwards onto the bed by his face. I have to work. I'll see you later. What it is to be a billionaire playboy with nothing to do but fuck all day.
Chapter 15. There's no grand double-height atrium at the Ritz, just one opulent lounge area leading into another, a sequence of antechambers. I make for the side exit on Arlington Street, reading the sightlines. The doorman raises his hat. He knows I came from the penthouse suite. Don't ask me how. It's going to be a golden day. I head down the street, sucking in lungfuls of early morning air, turn the corner, and end up on St. James's.
The wide bow windows of gentlemen's clubs stare down at me. I turn the corner into Pall Mall, past the flaming torches outside the RAC club, past the broad wide stairs onto the Mall, and out into Trafalgar Square. The steps are deserted. Come back in 5 hours and it will be packed. Students, hair blowing in the wind, tourists with selfie sticks. I cross the road outside the grand Art Deco front of Charing Cross Station and duck down a side alley. It is the perfect morning to walk along the river to the city, but I force myself into the tube. The tired yellow tiles of embankment look like a urinal, smell like a urinal too. Even early rush hour is busy. Commuters crowd the platforms. The tunnels are warm and airless after the freshness of the day. The train rumbles in the tunnel and comes into view. I keep my back to the curved wall. I saw a hit on a tube platform once. It stays with you. Never let anyone get between you and the wall. The train screeches to a halt. The doors beep and the crowd surge forward. I'm the last on as the doors close. I throw myself at the gap, forcing it apart, squashing myself through. People tut until they see me. Then they smile. Evening dress in the morning rush hour will do that. I lean up against the door, hanging from the rail. The proximity is comforting. It reminds me of my teenage years when I used to ride the tube just to feel close to someone. I close my eyes, and the Prince of Darkness is standing there, smiling at me. I want to call out to him. I get off at Monument. The underground link to Bank is deserted. This time of day, everyone is in too much of a hurry to walk. I set off up the silent passageway. Footsteps echo down the tunnel. Someone is approaching in a hurry. Running. I resist the urge to start running myself. Maybe they're late for something. I touch my locator in my ear. Is this it? Here, in this deserted tunnel. Closer and closer the footsteps come. They are running full tilt towards me. Shoes, not trainers, a man, light but tall, the strides are long. I stand still and wait. The runner turns a bend in the tunnel. Simon. His messy hair is swept back with the speed. He screeches to a halt, rocking with the forward momentum, and puts his hands on his knees, gasping. I breathe out, more tense than I realized. I slap him on the back, trying not to laugh.
Firestorm, Winter,
he chokes. Finally. There is a contract out on me, and I actually feel relieved. I pat his back. It was to be expected.
No, you don't understand, he gasps.
Just breathe, I say, amused. Christ, you're unfit. He stands upright and starts to drag me back down the tunnel the way he has come. He's surprisingly strong. I let him drag me, half laughing, half protesting. If it's less than 50 grand, I'm going to complain.
$100 million, he says. Flat fee, no auction.
What? It's a mistake, I say. He shakes his head and I see the panic in his eyes. Now, there's determination. Any minute he'll be trying a fireman's lift. The first time we met, he carried me unconscious across a nightclub. All right, all right. I hold my hands up, conceding defeat, and we break into a run. We pound down the tunnel and up the escalators. Now we're in Bank Station, on the level below the ticket hall. We dive into the tunnel on the right and down a short flight of steps onto the westbound Central Line platform. A train has just left and the platform is full of people hurrying up the platform for the exit. The air is thick with black fumes. We thread our way along to the far end and duck through a scuffed service door behind a ladder to the track. The spiral staircase is lit by emergency lighting. It ends in a tiny lobby. An iron fire door blocks the way. Simon heaves a huge sigh of relief as we enter the security capsule.
detainment suite, he orders. The GCHQ canteen is on the 10th floor below street level. Simon is still arguing as we hit the swing doors. You have to go to the detainment suite. It isn't safe here. I roll my eyes at him. What, the GCHQ canteen? Now you are being ridiculous. I beam at the white-jacketed guy behind the counter. There are trays and trays in front of him. Bacon, hash browns, mushrooms, beans, sausages, eggs, scrambled, fried and poached. Everything winter? He gestures with a spoon the size of a fist. Right you are. I point at the food. Maybe it's poisoned. I put my hands to my cheeks, doing my impression of Munch's scream. Simon scowls. Keep your voice down. It could be all the food in the place. What? Just to get at me? I grin. It is quite funny. $100 million is a fuck of a lot of money to throw at a problem. Boy, does he value his anonymity. Simon's mouth twists, but he doesn't say anything. The room is half full, well into the main sitting. GCHQ doesn't sleep. Technicians, data analysts, research analysts. The bug hunters sit together. The Doris and Dennis minders, support staff, cleaners. It's not a threatening lineup. The place rings with morning chatter, the clink of cutlery, the scrape of china, 100 bodies in a confined space. There is everything and nothing to read. A window stretches the full length of the room, overlooking the arena, a triple-height, football-pitch-sized underground training area. I can see a couple of sessions in full swing. I breathe deeply. Bacon overpowers everything. I look at Simon's worried face. Relax, I say, clapping him on the shoulder. I plonk my tray on a table by the window and sit down. I have my back to the door, and it gives me a prickle of unease. Curious eyes stare and look away. Everyone knows I was missing. What news of Slashstorm? I say, thinking of 12 faces and a girl with wide brown eyes. Simon sits down opposite me and pulls the bowl of sugar sachets towards him. No change. I look at Simon's tray in disgust. Is that all you're having? A coffee and a banana? I have every one of the hot breakfast options. Simon eyes my tray. Carb loading? Don't go there, I warn, pointing my knife at him, my mouth full of bacon. I am not allowing him to dictate what I put in my face. That's what Viv did to Eric until he found himself eating egg white omelette. Simon is decimating packs of sugar. He's so wired. You really have to deal with your anger management issues, I say. His face flickers into a half smile, but he doesn't say anything. So, I prompt, what have we got? Live number, he says. Still triangulating down, but it looks like Italy. Umbria. Rural. Someone is behind me. Too close. Simon's face stills as he stares over my shoulder. Then he is launching himself across the table at something above my head. I throw myself sideways off my chair and feel pain in my shoulder. A blade has made it through the satin, right where my heart would have been a fraction of a second before. I roll, bouncing up to face my attacker. It's a bug hunter, the evolutionary successor of a Bletchley Park codebreaker. He has a blade in one hand and a look of determination on his face. I see the knife coming and feel the adrenaline rise. I spin and plant a roundhouse kick to his jaw with all the strength I have. The bug hunter flies back against the curved plastic of the food counter. The knife soars through the air, landing with a crash, and skitters across the floor. A wall of noise rushes back. I'm standing in an empty circle of space while people scream around me. Simon is trying to press napkins to the hole in my shoulder. A couple of figures bend over the fallen bug hunter. Medics. I don't need them to tell me he's dead. I have killed him with a kick. I slam through the canteen double doors. They smash against the wall. In my own bloody office, son of a bitch. Simon follows in the wake of my anger, jogging to keep up. His shirt is splattered with fried egg. He lunges at my back, trauma pad in hand. I shake him off. A corner of me wonders where Simon has found a trauma pad. Maybe he carries them around with him. I hold my right hand to my shoulder. Blood wells through the fingers. It's nothing, nothing. Surface, I tell him. The GCHQ incident room is the size of a boardroom and the best place in the UK to run a live op. The room is dark, the air cold on my face. I flick the switch and the lights burst into life down the long room. The light bounces off rows and rows of equipment ready and waiting for action. Banks of blank screens. It smells of cold. This is the ultimate. A hacker's wet dream. There is nowhere this room can't go. The bunker can handle most things, but I am taking no chances. Simon stands by the door. Indecision pours off him. Get Max here. Winter, this is the last resort. Let's not waste it. Do it. Simon shakes his head, but sits down at a terminal, pulling on a headset. 2 minutes later, Max walks in the room. His beard has crumbs of crunchy in it. He's been running, and is trying not to let it show. It's 10 years since I hacked the service on his watch. He still hasn't forgiven me. Get a trace started. I pick up a headset and wait, tapping my nails on the desk. Max is already firing up the kit. He personally modified the location software. He needs no persuasion to use it. Dial it, I order. Once we light up the line, that will be it. They both nod their heads in agreement, synchronized bobbing. Do it. Simon looks across, waiting for Max's nod. When it comes, he sighs as he presses the number he has just traced into the dealer board. This is it. Shit or bust. I wipe my fingers on my white satin and press the headphones to my ears. The Prince of Darkness answers on the first ring. You fucking missed, I spit. There is laughter. I close my eyes as I picture him laughing at me. He is so close I could almost touch him. Come and do your own dirty work, coward. There is an intake of breath and silence. The laughter has stopped. That has shut him up. Then he is laughing, laughing so hard he holds the phone away from his face, and this time there is real amusement in his voice. I can see him backlit by flames, laughing and laughing. You're so funny, little girl. Get out of my head, I whisper. He stops laughing. What? He says, his voice quiet. Silence swirls around us, cocooning us in a bubble of intimacy. I can feel him on the end of the phone. I can hear his breathing. I can see the strong line of his jaw, the curve of his lips as he holds the phone to his face, considering. The satin feels hot. Max holds up his finger. He's close to a full trace, but I don't care. I stare down the long, empty room. I am coming, I promise, my voice full of venom. I'm looking forward to it. I can hear the smile. He pauses, then cuts the call. On the other side of the desk, Max gives a double thumbs up. Relief mingles with surprise on Simon's face. He can't believe it. I throw down the headset and rush round to look at the findings. Tell me it's Moscow, I beg. It's all slotting into place. Umbria. Umbria? My mind goes blank. Umbria in Italy.
It has to be a mistake. It's the same mast again. A micro cell.
It is not a mistake.
He set out from there to go to Geneva 4 days ago, and he's back there now. Simon is coming to the same conclusion.
Umbria is home.
I can't believe it. Chapter 16. Control looks up as I burst through his office door. He keeps looking at the door as if trying to make a point.
Self-defense, he says. I'll write it up as a training accident.
In the canteen.
I can't understand why you were out of the detainment area in the first place. Don't leave it again until you have a name.
I have a better plan. Viv, I say. I need her help. Viv, Eric's quartermaster and the only person bar Simon I trust with my life.
Anyone else, Winter? She is on psychiatric leave. She is never going to get cleared for duty.
Viv went postal after Eric was killed.
I fold my arms across my chest. We stare at each other.
I can see him weighing it all up. Me versus medical.
Silence.
Across the room, tiny silky moths flutter against a piece of sticky cardboard. A pheromone trap. They throw themselves at it again and again. It makes me want to help them. I turn away so I can't see their struggles. The silence stretches out. Apparently the balance tips in my favour, because eventually he nods once, quickly. I don't bother to thank him as I head for the door.
Winter, don't leave the detainment suite again. That's an order.
Simon trails me into the lift. Where is Viv? I ask him. Whatever he was expecting, it wasn't this. Viv, I demand. He shakes his head, as if to clear it.
She is in pieces. Good for nothing. No one can reach her.
She wasn't there. Take me to her. He blanches.
Winter, you cannot leave the building. $100 million. Who knows what the fuck is out there?
It has to be me. He swallows.
But, Winter, there are probably snipers on every rooftop. We will be lucky to avoid someone ram-raiding the building.
We take a squad car, in the end. I don't trust any of the tube exits, and Simon refuses to let me out on the street. As the car skirts Old Street and heads down Bethnal Green Road, my heart sinks. I have a bad feeling about where we're going. We pull up outside a terrace in Mile End, a GCHQ safe house. Viv has gone back to the last place she saw Eric. Pain twists in my gut. I wasn't there for him. We were neither of us there. He is lying on a bedroom floor with a 9mm hole in his forehead. I undo my seatbelt slowly. Simon shakes his head.
It's not good, he says. He doesn't meet my eyes. I can't reach her. She would have given her life for Eric, and she wasn't even there.
I'm surprised by the sensitivity of the comment. At least she wasn't drinking coffee and playing solitaire, I say, slapping his shoulder. Not that I have ever actually caught him at it. Simon looks away. He starts to unbuckle his seatbelt, but I stop him. I'll go on my own.
What are you going to see? He asks.
I have no idea. I open the front door and close it softly behind me. The house is silent. I can guess where she will be, and I make my way wearily up the threadbare stairs. The boards show through the red patterned carpet. The smell of old house fills the air. It is in the very bones of the place.
You could take out every stick of furniture, every rug, every piece of carpet, and it would still be there. I reach the top of the stairs. The door to the back bedroom is open. Viv is sitting on a chair with her back to the door. How long has she been like that? Today there's no draft from the windows. It's a warm day. She stares out at the garden. There's nothing from her back, not a flicker of movement, nothing to acknowledge my arrival. I walk round until I'm standing between her and the window. I don't know what I was expecting to see in her eyes. Maybe tears, maybe pain. Something. There is nothing. Empty black pools of nothing, enough to drown us both. And suddenly, I know what to do. I turn away for a moment, then spin back, my left hand extending, and the full force of a knife hand strike smacks into the side of her face. I feel it connect and wonder how many bones I'm going to have to break. It's my last moment of detachment. It's a very long time since anyone landed a blow on Viv, and even longer since she took a hit to the face. She falls to the floor, but the eyes that look up at me through a tangle of dark, lanky hair are angry and focused. I leap out of the way of the round kick that would have broken my ankle and boot her straight in the guts as hard as I can. There's a crunch of rib. She rolls away, and now she is rising on the other side of the chair, her face murderous. I lunge across the gap, capitalizing on my superior reach, but she dances and blocks and lands a kick to the chest that knocks me backwards. Her fists are up and she weighs in with a classic attack pattern. As a fifth Dan, she technically outranks me, but the advantages of being combat ready are all with me. I block and land a second knife hand strike on her neck that takes her down. I stand, my fists clench, breathing hard. But she's not getting up. I crouch down beside her and lift her head by the lank hair. I need you, I say. I explain to her what I want. It's terrifying. Her eyes close and she nods. As I sweep out, she whispers something that might be thank you. Simon is waiting for me in the car. That was quicker than I expected. How is she? He takes in my breathing and leans forward. Is someone there? He demands. Another hit! I shake my head and sink into the seat, rubbing at my eyes with the back of my hand. The service Range Rover drives us back through the titanium blast doors and into the holding bay. The underground car park is quiet, lit by the usual flickering strip light. I hesitate outside the security capsule. Simon's hair stands up in small peaks, he's so tense. I don't trust GCHQ. I don't trust the service Range Rover. I pull Simon into the shadow of a concrete pillar and whisper in his ear. Not very high tech. I'm going off grid. Viv is going to wear my locator. Simon stares at me. No one can know. Lock her up in the detainment suite and say I'm looking at faces 24/7. Where are you going? Umbria. Norway, Winter. Are you mad? Full appearance transfer. I need you to book me in. The works, facial implants, hair, everything. The thoughts scud across his face, one after the other. There are so many things about this plan that he doesn't like. He homes in on the biggest one. No locator. I shake my head. Think about it. We're full of leaks. That is bad enough at the best of times. Now there's $100 million worth of incentive. Simon's face grapples with the problem. But then how can I support? I grip his arms. We are dealing with someone with live assets in the GCHQ building. Someone with government-grade surveillance capabilities. If you can see me, he can see me. I need to slip under his radar, and I have 10 days left to do it.
His mouth twists as his common sense concedes the logic. So we give him something to watch. He knows I have a photographic memory. He knows I know about the contract. He'll expect me to sit tight and find him in the systems.
What does Control say?
I shake my head. Shit, he says. But will you help me? He stares at me for a long moment, then he looks away. You don't need to ask.
Chapter 17.
Smooth olive skin and dark hair fill my thoughts. I call the Ritz. The Major Domo answers. I can't come round later, I say. Some things come up.
Can you meet him for a quick drink?
Why? Does he think I want to date him? He names a bar within 5 streets of GCHQ, almost like he knows where I am. It must be fate. Maybe for 15 minutes, 20 max. I pull off my locator and leave it on the desk. I climb the stairs 2 at a time and arrive in reception via the stairwell lobby. Reception is busy. It always is. I stroll out through the main doors like I haven't a care in the world. I figure with 4 subterranean and a road exit to GCHQ, no one will be expecting me to walk out the front door. I don't pause to scan the rooftops, but cross Cheapside briskly, weaving through the lines of cars like a bike courier and ducking down a narrow alleyway that leads to Gresham Street. A minute later, I'm in the King's Arms Yard, an alley stretching between Coleman Street and Moorgate. A hangover from medieval London's street layout. The bar sign creaks. The Highwayman. It would be a perfect place for a hit. Good lines of sight. I glance up at the roofs as I duck under the threshold. Roman stands at the bar with his back to me. A fine grey wool suit stretches in a perfect fit across his shoulders and hangs from his hips. The barman smiles up at him. The halo effect. Roman was born thinking the whole world smiles. He turns away with a word of thanks, carrying a bottle of beer and a long, tall drink. His hair flops down across his face. I remember it plastered across his forehead as he begged me not to stop. He catches sight of me and smiles, and the room lights up. I hunch my shoulder away from the bar cams and walk over. He's close enough to touch when his trouser pocket starts to vibrate. I lean forward. Is that a phone in your pocket, or are you just pleased to see me? I grin as I palm the phone. Retro, I comment, looking down at it. Not what you would expect from a billionaire playboy's brother. He scowls when he sees it in my hand. He thrusts the drink down on the table and tries to snatch it back. I hold it out of his reach, looking at the caller ID. The Cyrillic characters catch me out for a moment, and I squint down at them. It's your brother, I say. Roman swears some more and grabs it from me. I drop the phone and back off, holding my arms out, palms up in surrender. I get a picture of the stern older brother lecturing about women. Roman cuts the call without answering and throws the phone down on the table. You can answer, I say, puzzled. I don't mind. Roman shakes his head. He stares down at the phone. What is it? I ask, reaching across the gap, half amused, half concerned. Don't say he's cutting your allowance. The joke is in poor taste. I see the anger in his face. His eyes rake the bar, scanning as if he's looking for trouble. He glances behind him. He shakes his head irritably. Forget my brother. He leans forward and takes my hand. I notice my split knuckles and pull it away quickly. He stares into my face. What happened to you? I drag hair over my sore cheek. I walked into a door. With your fists? It's a fair point.
The phone on the table between us shrieks in the silence. It does a little jig on the polished wooden surface. I sit back and gesture to it. You'd better speak to him. Roman stares at the phone for a moment, then snatches it off the table, rising and turning away. He's annoyed, and something else. Time to go. I slide out of the booth, drink untouched, and head for the exit. At the door, I pause for a moment to watch him. He's speaking rapidly and urgently in Kazakh. By the time he turns, I'm gone. Chapter 18. I hit Gatwick at 11 o'clock at night, roughly 8 hours before my flight to Perugia, Italy. Simon would brook no arguments, and after the facial alteration people had done their work, I was in no mood for a fight. Airside at Gatwick is one of the safest places in the UK. If Simon had his way, I would spend my life airside. There's more military hardware held here than there is at the barracks in Hyde Park. They're on red alert. They are expecting a terrorist attack. They are expecting hidden weapons. They have trained for a ground assault on the terminal. I wait patiently in line at check-in. Around me, the airport is still full. Tired, drawn faces, mothers with little kids up hours past their bedtime, business travellers heading home. I am next in line. I walk up to the desk and smile at the woman behind it. She is young and groomed and glossy, with a wide smile and a neat little red scarf round her neck. There is something about air hostesses, like you could ask them for a happy ending. I put my passport on the desk. Who am I today? I squint down at the passport photo. Did you pack the bag yourself? No, it was packed for me by my quartermaster. I don't even know what's in it. Yes. And has it been out of your sight since you packed it? This is the first time I've seen it. No. Do you have any of these? She pushes a card of prohibited items towards me. Apart from the 8 ceramic throwing knives? No. Have a nice flight. She hands my flight documents over the counter. Nice. I revise my views on the happy ending. I stare at myself in the vast grey airside bathroom. The smell of commercial toilets catches in the back of my throat. Stale urine mingles with industrial bleach. The brilliant white light hurts my eyes. My hair has been cut, and someone else's woven onto it. My new hair hangs in black waves to my shoulders. Pale skin, black hair, red lips. I look like Snow White. My dark eyes sparkle, brown contacts. I trace the silicone beneath my cheekbones and along my jaw. The surgeons have done an unbelievable job. Snow White's face is heart-shaped after the inserts. Winter is gone. Snow White sounds like a firestorm contractor handle. I down a couple of ibuprofen for the swelling, and Snow White winks at me. She is hot. The main concourse is brightly lit and bustling. There's no such thing as night here. The place is open 24/7. The shiny glass shop fronts never close. I drift past confectioners, coffee shops, donut sellers, miles and miles of duty-free. Every shop counter has tiny pieces of product to taste. You could survive here on freebies. Warm offerings line up on the counter of Hotel Chocolat, tequila sunrise specials, caramel puddles. You could survive until the diabetes or the scurvy or the boredom got you. I stare up at the nearest camera, wondering if Simon is watching. There are more cameras here per square foot than the bank interchange, but facial recognition software works on 9 contour points on the human face. You only have to alter 4 of them to baffle the software. I walk all the way around until I find myself back at Hotel Chocolat. The place is a huge hexagon. There's no escaping.
A weird microcosm of a world, an ecosystem of scarves and bags and chocolate and bright, smiling shopgirls, their heavy foundation almost orange in the harsh lighting. I sit down on one of the plastic chairs in the very centre of the shopping mecca and stretch my legs out in front of me. The chairs are linked together in a continuous piece of moulded plastic. It is seriously uncomfortable. The curved shoulders of sleeping bodies stretch out on the narrow chairs, heads pillowed on hand luggage rucksacks. There is nowhere you can get your back to the wall. I am never going to sleep here. What am I going to do for the next 8 hours? I get up and go back to wandering the shop fronts. Everywhere I look, someone is trying to sell me something. A bored teenager sits in front of racks of earrings, hair bobbles, bikinis. She is doing the merchandise justice. She has at least 8 piercings that I can see. Golden hazel eyes look up and meet mine, and I find myself wondering what else she has pierced. I wander over. "Late shift?" I ask. She nods, sizing me up. "I've just come on." A silver ball on the end of her tongue flashes as she speaks. I picture what you can do with a tongue stud. Several things you can do. "I'm worth $100 million, I say. "Snow White is crazy." She laughs. "Bullshit! Who has that kind of money?" She is right. Very, very few people. He should be easy to spot in a 5-mile radius. I smile. I pull a polka dot bikini off a nearby rail and hold it up against me. "Do you think this is my size?" She considers, eyeing up my figure. "You need a bigger top," she concludes. I close the gap between us and hold the polka dot bikini up against her chest. "You try it," I suggest. I put my head on one side, so I can see what it looks like. "Are you fucking with me?" she demands, her hands on her hips. Apparently this is an unusual request. I picture her on her knees. "If you like," I say. The changing room cubicle is small. 2 polka dot bikinis stand side by side, looking in the mirror. The girl with the tongue stud's golden eyes are wide. Snow White pushes her to the wall. I cup her jaw in both hands. Her hair feels silky beneath my fingertips. My thumbs trace her lower lip. I bend my head and whisper, feather light against her mouth. Her lips open. The stud is warm on my tongue. When I look back in the mirror, Snow White is pushing the shop girl to her knees and leaning back against the door. I close my eyes and grip the silky hair, controlling the movement. After a while, my hands brace against the walls. I sweep the clothes off the chair, sit down, and slide her bikini bottoms off. I pull her backwards onto me, and my eyes hold hers in the mirror. Her mouth forms a perfect O, with a tongue stud in the middle, as my right hand moves downwards. I speed up and slow down until her head thrashes from side to side and her skin is sheened in sweat. It's not long before her back arches and she screams against my neck as her body jackknifes over and over. I yawn and stretch. There is a grey speckled wall 2 inches from my nose. I jerk fully awake. Where am I? A grey plastic cell about 4 foot by 4 foot. No wonder I was dreaming about stretching. The changing room is completely enclosed. There's no gap at the top or bottom, and I realize I've slept soundly for hours. I sit up and the strange woman with dark brown eyes and the just fucked hair stares at me an infinite number of times. I grin back at her as memory fills in the blanks. Why have I never thought of a changing room before?
My watch is flashing 6:30 a.m. My flight is probably on final call. I unlock the cubicle and step out. The girl with the tongue stud is standing at the till, ringing up a basket of scarves. She must have let me sleep. She waves at me.
"They are just so beautiful, I had to have them," the customer is saying.
"Yeah," the girl with the tongue stud says. "Yeah, I know what you mean."
Chapter 19. It's 10 a.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. in Italy, by the time the plane taxis to a halt. I step onto the flimsy metal gantry, and the wall of hot air hits me. There's no sign of the fortress security of Gatwick. Here they see 2 flights a day, 1 flight in the morning and the same flight back in the afternoon. The man at border control looks into my eyes, not at my passport.
"Ciao, bellissima," he says. "Welcome to Italy."
As I cross the main concourse heading for the taxis, I can't even see a camera. The place is deserted. I buy a guidebook from the only kiosk and watch the taxi queue. The 4th driver along is stuffing pizza into his face, balancing a cup of something on his dashboard. As he moves forward, I head out from the shadows and slip into place in the queue. He is still stuffing pizza in his face as we drive off.
"Welcome to Italy," he says.
Umbria rolls past, walled hilltop towns, golden vistas, and heat. Across the opposite valley, I can see a field of olives, silvery bushes in neat lines. A pale road snakes its way between the fields, disappearing out of sight behind the borders of dark green. The heat haze dulls the middle distance and beyond, like a movie scene shot through Vaseline. I see our destination from miles away. The sandstone walls of an ancient fortress town rise out of the tree line. Medieval slit windows in the castle tower watch the plain. It is the home of our microcell and the center of the search area. Somewhere in its small radius is the most wanted man in the world, and he has no idea I'm here. Anticipation stabs at me. I'm closer to bringing him down than anyone has ever been, closer to ending Firestorm's reign. I picture the 12 faces and the 12 counters on the Slashstorm homepage, and my heart starts to race. Breathe. The road disappears behind scrubby trees as it starts to climb, hiding the town from view. We pass little brown houses, their windows blind in the blazing heat, and squares of golden flowers, fields of maize. Suddenly we round a bend above the tree line, and the stone walls come into view. I climb out of the taxi and thank the driver in my broken Italian. He is still eating as he drives off. The squat clock tower in the main square sounds a single echoing note, an iron bell ringing the half hour from rusty chains. The white painted clock face is unreadable. A cobbled street too narrow for cars leads to the stone castle with its high tower. The place is deserted. Even the birds are silent in the brutal heat of the midday sun. There is no sign of the mast, but I know it's there. The local government preserves the integrity of the ancient monuments like a mother guards a child. It will be there. As I climb higher, the houses are built into the stone castle walls. Once they were probably little better than hovels. Now they are painted and tiled and gentrified. A small plaque on the corner reads, "Jewish Quarter, 14th to 19th century." I round the bend, and I'm at the top, at the foot of the tower. It's a ruin, a facade, with nothing behind. A spreading cedar grows on the corner of the parapet, buckling the stone wall with its mighty roots. It stands on the very brink. Below it, the sheer wall of the keep fortifications, and below them, the city walls themselves. I can see tens of miles across the plain. I can almost see the sea.
"Where are you?"
He was here 6 days ago, and he was here yesterday. This has to be home. Where does the most powerful man in the world call home? Tiny little houses dot the valley floor, churches, monasteries. I try to picture the Prince of Darkness in a monastery. It makes me laugh. Where to start? I peer over the railings on the town side. A roof terrace, neat clipped box hedges, bougainvillea, rosemary, lavender. A scent tsunami. Coiled green hoses curl through the flower beds, fighting a losing battle against the heat. It is as good a place as any. I vault over the handrail and drop the 15 feet or so to the terrace below, rolling as I hit the deck. The roof terrace of a private house, double doors with slatted wooden blinds stand open onto a room beyond. I step through. An elderly man and his tiny wife sit in armchairs looking out at their roof terrace. Octogenarians. I take in the faded grandeur of the decor. I smile winningly. Just passing through, I say, heading for the stairs. They watch me go without interest. At their age, nothing surprises them. I fight my way past pot plants on stands and armchairs on the curve of the stairs until I am in the hall. Spider plants die against the wall. The Prince of Darkness doesn't live here. I open the front door, and I'm out on the main street. I cross the street. The houses on this side have the plain at the back. I duck into the dark doorway of the house opposite. A bead curtain slaps my bare shoulder as I push through. A small square room leads directly to the back of the house. My mouth drops open. A plate glass window overlooks the plain, hundreds of feet above ground level. A woman enters, carrying a basket of sheets. She looks at me in surprise. "I am so sorry, madam," I say, smiling. "I wanted to see the view." She stares after me as I turn to go. 2 hours later, I am footsore and weary with nothing to show for it. I have checked every possible option in this walled town and drawn a blank. I head to the cafe in the main square and order a coffee. The wooden tables are sticky, but the cafe owner smiles. Snow White gets a lot of smiles. Lime trees hang heavy over the tables, dripping sap. Beside me, an English couple speaks slowly and clearly, their vowels precise as they try to order lunch. The cafe owner stands patiently, tea towel in hand, making no attempt to help them out. The Englishman's linen jacket hangs limp over the back of his chair. I lift his phone while he frowns with the effort of communication. "Should it be this hot in early May?" he says, like it's some personal affront. Simon answers on the first ring. "Nothing," I say. "I'm going to check the outliers. I've got 50 revenue returns in the higher tax and one super tax," he says. "Population data mining. I can't see the Prince of Darkness filing a tax return. And one Ferrari owner. That sounds more promising." He reads out the location. "Check for square footage," I say. "There's no way he lives in a bungalow." Simon grunts. "How's Viv?" "Fine. Waiting to kick some butt." I can hear the smile in his voice. I cut the call. No one had long enough to get a trace, and if the GCHQ systems are compromised, Simon is in the detainment suite, and not on his own workstation. I peel a note from the wad Simon has given me, and leave it on the table, weighted by the coffee cup. The Englishman has noticed the absence of his phone. "I definitely had it," he is saying. "Just now, I was checking the cricket scores." "And we wonder why Europe was happy to let us go." "Maybe it's fallen out," his wife suggests. He growls irritably. "How can it have fallen out?" I lean down and pretend to pick up something out of the dust. "Is this it?" I say. "It was on the floor." Lucky it's not smashed.
It is bloody hot. The Englishman was right. He should try wearing Kevlar mesh in this heat. I head back to the viewing terrace at the very top of the citadel for a better look at my surroundings. On the other side of the castle, the southern side, the land slopes away sharply. Dry, dusty terraces punctuated with clustered forests of dark green. A line of tall, thin cypresses curves up the opposite hillside out of the valley, their long, pointed, horizontal shadows a ladder against the green. They curve from the valley floor to the brow of hill and disappear over the top, carrying the eye up and over, beyond the middle distance and into the far away. My eyes give up trying to distinguish colour and form, the hill silhouetted against the pale blue sky. Crowning the summit of the far valley, almost hidden from view by the tower, is another castle. It makes up the pair. These two castles guarded the plain 1,000 years ago, looking down from their opposite sides. I squint into the distance. Is it a ruin like this one? I stare at the forbidding walls. My neck feels suddenly cold. The stone shimmers in the heat haze, moving in and out of my vision. It is just out of our 5-mile square, but I like it. I like it a lot. For the first time since I arrived, I can see somewhere the Prince of Darkness might call home. It is 4 p.m. and blisteringly hot by the time I reach the settlement on the opposite side of the valley. I walk into the main square, the tarmac soft beneath my feet. My bare arms prickle, my hot skin scenting the air. Little stone houses with pots of red geraniums at their windows line the square on 3 sides. The place is deserted, the stone houses shuttered against the heat. Not deserted. Sleeping. The only movement is from the fountain in the center. A bronze swan reaches up to the sky. I watch the water fall, the play of light through the curtain of silver. Hundreds of wasps dance a mad dance of aerial suicide. A ramp, the width of a car, leads up to the castle. It disappears out of sight round a bend. No cameras that I can see. A tourism plaque is nailed on the wall at the bottom. That throws me. I take a few hesitant steps up the ramp, to the corner. An old fig grows on the bend. I hang in its shadows, reading the space. The green musk of fig, sweating through sandpaper leaves, is everywhere. I walk on into the castle courtyard. There are brackets for torches all around the walls. Medieval. A low brick wall in the center could be a well. Dark green moss circles the rim, bleeding down the wall and out across the dusty gravel. One side is a tower, the other 3 sides look like barracks, squat and unfinished. Monstrous stone greyhounds with collars of iron stand guard. It is completely deserted. Not a car, not even a cat. No sign of life. There are iron bars on the windows that look out onto the courtyard. I peer through chicken wire. The gloomy little cell is derelict. A pigeon shuffles across the dirty floor. I turn to face the castle. In the corner on the far right, a tiny doll-sized door is propped open. I skirt the edge of the courtyard and stand undecided, peering into the gloom through the tiny door. The stillness is absolute. I take a step inside and then another. The room is cool, several degrees cooler than the baking afternoon sun, and high, with windows above eye level. It leads into a huge hall with a domed ceiling. The space is completely empty. No furniture, no signs of life. A magnificent Renaissance staircase rises gracious to the first floor in 3 even stages. I creep slowly up the stairs, an intruder in the beast's castle, my tourist guidebook in front of me like a shield. I pause on the landing, listening.